The 1994 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Neither Nor, Philosophical Issues and Confusions in the Debate on Mormon History by Bill Martin.
We'd like to welcome you to session 326 of the Sunstone Symposium. This session is entitled Neither Nor, Philosophical Issues and Confusions in the Debate on Mormon History. The paper will be read by Bill Martin. Bill is Assistant Professor of Philosophy at DePaul University of Chicago. He has a PhD from the University of Kansas. He is the author of several books. Titles are Matrix and Line, Derrida and the Possibilities of Postmodern Social Theory, Humanism and Its Aftermath, The Shared Fate of Deconstruction and Politics, and also Politics in the Impasse, Explorations in the Post-Secular Social Theory. He also has a work in progress. Working title is Mormon Possibilities, A Theory of Community. We'll now hear from Professor Martin, and following his paper, we'll open it up for questions.
Good morning. A few years ago, there was a cartoon in the New Yorker magazine that clearly aimed to poke fun at the academic fashions of the 80s, hermeneutics, relativisms of various sorts, deconstruction, paradigm shifts, postmodernism, et cetera, all the isms made popular in the 80s in this country. And the scene in the cartoon was a courtroom, and the bailiff was swearing in a witness with the following words: "Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and not in any kind of sneaky, relativistic, hermeneutical way?" And besides raising the issue concerning clever ways to get out of dealing with the truth, the cartoon also seemed to posit the idea that there is an alternative to supposedly suspect postmodern conceptions, namely an unproblematic, so-called straightforward account of the truth. And these issues are also present in the debate on Mormon historiography. And indeed, one account, which I'll turn to in just a moment, has it that the alternatives available to Mormon historians are positivism, which would seem to be just this straightforward account, and subjectivism, which would seem to give up altogether on the possibilities of the empirical verification of historical assertions, historical claims. And my aim here is to deal with that pair of supposed alternatives, positivism and subjectivism, and then to move beyond that and deal with what has been offered as the alternative to that alternative, namely a more hermeneutical approach using work taken from philosophers such as Hans-Georg Gadamer, Immanuel Levinas, and Jacques Derrida. This is the approach that, as you no doubt know, has been put forward by especially David Bone of the poli-sci department down at the Y. And in writing this paper, I actually found that the material contains so much, and this was even when I sort of narrowed my inquiry to just one essay from each of the main protagonists in the debate, because as you know, this just goes back and forth, ad infinitum, and to some extent ad nauseum. And I think to some extent there's maybe some egos involved, and also various other kinds of political stakes and institutional stakes. I tried to limit my inquiry to just looking at sort of what I thought of as the best statement of a particular person's position. And even then, I found there was too much, and so I found myself about a month ago writing a massive, sprawling paper that's just getting longer and longer. And so out of that, I thought I would just sort of distill some points down, talk for about a half hour, 35 minutes. We don't have an official commentator, in part because I understand that the people who are involved in this debate were all asked if they'd like to comment, and they wouldn't touch it. So, of course, most of them are at the Y, and that's fine. And I'd simply look at that. I look at that as good, actually, because then I could lay out some points and get us on into the debate, and then let's hear from you and get into a general discussion and hash it out, kick it around a little bit. So let me just give you my broad framework, if you don't mind. So I would begin by talking about Marvin Hill's paper on positivism or subjectivism. And as you know, David Bohm rejects that position. I reject it also. I reject that those are the only positions that historians, Mormon or otherwise, can take up. And my general argument would be also that positivism and subjectivism isn't a true dichotomy or alternative, because really they're two sides of the same coin, and neither side stands. Even though there are aspects, as we'll get into, of positivism that could be defended, and we might look at the motivations of the positivist philosophers and ask ourselves, well, what were they after, and do we want to somehow try to save what it is that they were after? I frankly don't think, and as you probably know, David Bohm does not think, that positivism as a philosophical program is defensible. On the other hand, then when we turn to the alternative offered by Professor Bohm and to some extent by Professor Lewis Midgley, the more hermeneutical historicist alternative that takes it that, and quite rightly in my opinion, that takes it that there's no single piece of something called evidence that could either confirm or deny the Mormon understanding of things, the LDS understanding of things as a whole. I agree with that point of view, but when we turn to that alternative, I want to ask, well, is there any role whatsoever for something that we would call evidence, that something that we would call subjectivity? So the way the problem's been set out thus far in the debate, as I understand it, is that Marvin Hill offers us positivism or subjectivism. Take your pick. That's what you've got. Bohm rejects that and says, no, there's a further alternative, hermeneutics, a hermeneutical understanding of history. So now I'm just going to read parts from the paper and just hit on some basic points, and then if we need to fill that out more in the general discussion, we'll do that, recognizing that in an hour we're not going to be able to explore every aspect of this debate, but at a certain point I'll stop and at least you can get into the aspects that you'd like to explore. Now, Marvin Hill, as you know, gave a presidential address in May of 93 to the Mormon History Association, and this was the address called Positivism or Subjectivism. And he takes it, I don't think I'm misreading him here. He takes it that these are the alternatives. If you are approaching Mormon history, you've got to be one or the other, a positivist or a subjectivist. And I think I'm reading that right, because he uses expressions such as of the two philosophies, indicating that he believes that these are the two philosophical frameworks that are available. And he also, in his title, uses the word dilemma, which seems to indicate, you know, either or, that's it, take one or the other. And he doesn't take either framework as separately descriptive of the faith of believing Latter-day Saints. He argues that features of both frameworks, when combined, describe this faith, but with positivism supplying the most important elements, he seeks a middle ground, as he says, between a kind of hardcore, that's my term, positivism, one that a positivism, as he says, holds that the evidence is compelling and that the people of the world must all agree with them. He wants to back up from that a little bit, but he still wants to have this basic role for evidence, for historical fact, for digging up historical facts. He backs off a little bit from that, and then he backs off a little bit from what he calls extreme or radical subjectivism, the kind of subjectivism that holds that history has no meaning other than that which the individual historian gives to it in his or her mental reconstruction of the past, which is, you can probably see, is just a form of solipsism. The world is simply in my head. It's what I come up with. He backs off from the hardcore positivism and the radical subjectivism, but then he wants a combination of moderate positivism, moderate subjectivism, with positivism being the key term. Why? Because in that view, that keeps you anchored in the evidence and keeps you anchored in something like the real world, the truth. And then he goes on, and I imagine many of you have read this address in the journal, the Mormon History Journal. He goes on to say that those who reject this sort of synthesis, mainly relying on positivism, have to find themselves, and this is, of course, the position that he assigns to David Bone, Lewis Midgley, those would be the main people we'd talk about here. If they reject Hill's version of positivism, they can only find themselves in a radical subjectivism, which, as Hill says, this radical subjectivism is not a philosophy of faith, but one of what he calls modernist despair. And as he said, as Hill argues, if you give up on a sort of harder notion of the evidence and of the world, you can only find yourself, in Hill's view, coming up with the world as a kind of mental construct, which leads to a sort of solipsism, which leads to an extreme relativism, which leads to simply saying that, well, I'm a believing Latter-day Saint because I'm a believing Latter-day Saint. I have that faith, and that's the end of it, and there's nothing more to be said. And why is this a modernist despair, as Hill says? Well, in his view, because people find themselves in this position at a certain historical moment when they feel that, for whatever reason, so-called enlightenment thinking has unraveled and there's nothing else to cling to except the mental construct. And so in a certain sense, what Hill is saying is if you give up on his moderate positivism, a little subjectivism thrown in to sort of temper it, but I'll just call it moderate positive, if you give up on that, then you're heading into the swamp of radical subjectivity. And take your choice. Take your choice. Well, I'm going to cut that discussion a little bit short just by saying a couple things. Why isn't positivism defensible as a philosophical program? Because it can't ground itself. That's the point that the positivist philosophers themselves eventually came to. For example, a key tenet of positivism philosophically is what positivist philosophers such as Rudolf Carnap, the people who are around the Vienna Circle, what they called the verification principle. And what is that? Well, in a certain sense, it's a perfectly good principle. I think many people live by it, and I think one would be a fool, actually, to not live by it to a certain extent. But the verification principle simply says that if I make an assertion, it has to be, in some public sense, verifiable. Verifiable in the sense that if I make an assertion, there is a person on the other side of that door, I have to be able to say under what conditions would my assertion be confirmed and under what conditions would it be denied. And this would have to do with empirical verification, and it would have to do with public criteria. In other words, it can't just be a claim that I'm going to hold to no matter what. You know, you open the door, and at least to your point of view, there's no one there, but I keep saying, there's somebody there. Well, maybe I'll still claim that, but then you have every right to say, well, what are your criteria? Because we don't see anybody. Are you seeing something that we don't see? What is it? Can you explain it to us? Well, if I can't really, but if I just want to hold, you know, to the idea that there's somebody there, well, the positivists have a big problem with that, and you can see why. It makes a lot of sense to have a big problem with that. And as I say, I think one would be a fool to give up on that sort of general framework. But can the principle be grounded? Well, the problem that the verification principle ran into is that the reasoning that supposedly grounds it is circular. Namely, the problem is that the verification principle itself can't be verified. Can't be verified. Logical positivism is a form of empiricism, sometimes called logical empiricism. And what's the logical part? Well, the empiricist part is that we have verification, that we try to have criteria for verification, and the logical part is we try to clarify our thoughts so that we don't run into contradictions. But again, what does that mean in any kind of basic, grounded sense? Well, we again find ourselves in a certain kind of circle. Namely that, well, logic, even right down to the principle of identity and the principle of non-contradiction, doesn't seem to have any other ground than itself, and the fact that, yes, it is persuasive in a certain sense, very persuasive. Again, one would do well to hang, in most cases, with the principle of non-contradiction, the principle of identity. You'd find yourself, I think, in deep trouble very quickly if you just cast those things off. And that does tend to recommend those principles to us. But then what have I offered now? I've offered a practical criteria. I've offered the criteria, well, a good way to travel through life is to hang to these principles of non-contradiction, of verification. But I'm not offering any kind of philosophical ground now. I'm offering a pragmatic principle. And the problem then is that the sorts of things that have spoken to, as Lewis Midgley puts it, communities of faith and memory can't be fully explained by those principles, and yet to many people they make sense. And what do we mean by saying they make sense? Well, again, people live their lives in light of them. So again, a kind of practical criteria, and one that in some cases trumps, you might say, the practical criteria of non-contradiction and of verification. But I think Hill has a couple points to make, and I'm moving rather quickly, but I want to seize on these for a moment before I turn to David Bohn's arguments. The first point being that, well, if history gives up on any idea of the evidence and simply comes into the hermeneutic circle, as David Bohn would recommend, well, you know, that does seem to be a problem, because then you would have a view of history that's simply a faith, if you want to say that, and that could be a blind faith in the sense that nothing could falsify it. And that's a real problem. I mean, it's a real problem just for the same reasons that you would want to hang on to some sense of verification, some sense of non-contradiction. If nothing can falsify your point of view, well, you're on the way to being an uncritical mind, and you're on your way to not thinking at all, frankly. You're on your way to atrophying your brain. And that would seem to be a problem, and it would seem to be a problem that David Bohn, for instance, would want to avoid. I mean, why does he invoke philosophers from Europe, such as Jacques Derrida or Hans-Georg Gadamer, other than for the reason to critically think out these problems? So I would think he'd have some sympathy with wanting to avoid making yourself so that you're not thinking at all, but simply saying, well, I'm a Latter-day Saint because I'm a Latter-day Saint. Well, that doesn't explain very much, and the person who's not a Latter-day Saint can say the same thing. I'm not one because I'm not one. And you're not going to get very far with that. The second issue that I think Hill raises is that, and that I think is crucially important, and that Hill, David Bohn, Lewis Midgley, etc., aren't taking account of at all, is the fact that Hill's version of moderate positivism, leavened with some subjectivism, but basically moderate positivism, this is, as Hill argues, this is very much the philosophical position of the institutional church itself. This is the self-image of the church. So, as Hill says, for instance, for many of the Mormon people, establishing historical proofs for the Book of Mormon and other scriptures is so central to their faith, and then he goes on to say, that it's not likely that they can accept the radical subjectivism of David Bohn or Lewis Midgley. Now, I'm going to reject that Bohn or Midgley are really offering radical subjectivism. I don't think they are at all. And frankly, I think Hill's paper is littered with philosophical confusions on what subjectivism is. But on the other hand, I think he's right that most Mormon people do take this idea of proving the historicity of their faith to be quite central. And whether they're philosophically grounded in believing this or not, one does have to take account of the fact that this is the self-image of most Mormons, and especially the institutional church, the hierarchy. They're, in other words, they're positivists, and that's something we have to deal with. And it's interesting, actually, getting a little ahead of myself, but if you read the article by Bone that was in the last not the last one, but one issue ago, the larger issue article of by David Bone, which on the whole I think is a very good article. But you remember he opens the article with this discussion of what he calls the ethics of discussion and clearing the ground. And he says that these revisionist historians, these new Mormon historians, doesn't put everybody who calls themselves a new Mormon historian in the revisionist camp. But Hill would be one. D. Michael Quinn, etc., would certainly be in that camp from Bone's point of view. Bone says that these revisionist historians have advanced their cause not through arguments so much, but through stratagem, through political agendizing, through claiming that their view of things has been repressed and for that reason it needs to be brought forth. And what's problematic about that on Bone's part is that it's a bit disingenuous. It's a bit of a stratagem itself, because even while he's saying, let's clear the ground then, and he seems to offer this sort of massive olive branch, let's get back to peaceable, friendly discussion over the larger issue, philosophically, and let's not invoke politics and agendas, and let's not use stratagem to advance our cause. Well, of course, standing right behind him is a massive institutional authority that he doesn't have to invoke. He just has to let it be there. Much like, you know, if I could come to you and say, I come in peace, but of course I've got my enforcer standing behind me with, 10 megaton bomb or, sawed-off shotgun or whatever it's going to take. Well, then I don't have to invoke authority. It's just there. And it does its work. And what's the problem with that? Well, the funny problem is, to relate it back to this point about what is the self-image of most Latter-day Saints, in the sense of most Latter-day Saints, and certainly the church hierarchy, is interested in evidence. I mean, anybody who wants to walk over to the visitor center can see that they're interested in evidence, with all these little cases showing ancient sea voyages, etc. Obviously, they're interested in the evidence. Then Bone comes along and says, look, positivism philosophically isn't sustainable. No single piece of evidence is going to confirm or deny the Latter-day Saint understanding of things. No single piece of evidence is going to confirm or deny the historicity of the Book of Mormon, for example. And then he kind of makes a what he thinks of as a quantitative leap, but we have to ask whether it's a qualitative leap also, because he tends to go from no single piece of evidence to what really in the end amounts to no evidence whatsoever, and then this is why Hill says that that kind of view is subjectivism. But so then Bone offers instead the hermeneutic circle. And what I think is interesting about that in relation to Hill's claim about the self-image of Mormonism is that the hermeneutic circle isn't really much part of it. Jacques Derrida is not much part of how the church leadership understands the historicity of Mormon claims. And of course, the great irony would be if someday David Bone or Lewis Midgley would get a phone call from a general authority saying, we really don't need this hermeneutical stuff mucking up our understanding of stuff, so cut it out, please. You're just confusing everybody. You're not helping everyday Mormons. You're just one of those intellectuals. And, of course, the very thing that Bone and Midgley and others are accusing the revisionist historians of doing, of just intellectualizing Mormon history. And then, of course, their arguments involve some very difficult, abstract, somewhat intractable even for most people, philosophy. I'm gonna skip some examples of where Hill talks about historians such as Richard Bushman and Hugh Nibley taking a supposedly subjectivist turn, but we could get into them in the discussion, but I think they're just completely misguided, that the kinds of examples he gives to show this just don't show this. Don't show this at all. Now, why do I have actually a great deal of sympathy for Bone's approach? Let me just say a couple things about that. So despite what I just said, and despite what I think is a certain disingenuity on the part of Bone in his clearing the ground aspect of the discussion, philosophically, I do think it's a better framework for understanding not just Mormon history, but history more generally. For one thing, so there would be two things. Bone does criticize this idea of a neutral ground in the retrieval of history. And as Bone argues, this dogma, as he puts it, is so ingrained with some revisionists that it's simply taken as self-evident, as not requiring justification. And then those who challenge this dogma have been charged with blocking so-called free intellectual inquiry. And on the contrary, Bone claims, those who have sought to defend the possibility of a believing Mormon history are not trying to deny to historians the right to compose historical accounts in whatever way they wish. Well, it depends on what you mean by deny. Not to deny in general, but possibly to deny within the framework of the church itself. But I don't know that that's such a problem. That's something we ought to get into. It's a problem, of course, for the people who find themselves being denied. But... well, let's just get into it later if you want to. And it's funny because then Bone follows this claim by saying, after all, it is a free country. And what's interesting here is that what Bone argues is that the revisionist historians tout these supposedly neutral intellectual standards of professionalism and neutrality, as though these themselves are transparent, self-defining terms, objectivity also, and that would have something called Mormon history constructed along the same lines as any other product of the secular academy. And as Bone says, well, it's a free country, you can do that. And I take it that there's a bit of irony when he says that. At least I hope there is, because I hope what he's saying is, you're certainly free to abandon anything that is particular or central to the Mormon community and free to join the larger secular society. And then in this regard, it seems to me the second point, so the first point being that this idea that there's some transparent criteria called professionalism, when Bone critiques that, I basically agree with this critique. That, you know, somehow this is a self-defined category. And then secondly, we see the liberal aspect of this conception of neutral professionalism critiqued by Bone, and I more or less agree with this critique there also. And I wanted to mention in this connection, I think it's interesting actually, that the same issue of Sunstone that contains Bone's essay on the larger issue also contains an essay by Levi Peterson called The Art of Dissent among the Mormons. And to me, the essay of Peterson's shows exactly what is wrong with the point of view that Bone is critiquing. And in my opinion, my humble opinion, I mean, there are some good things in Peterson's essay, and I certainly think that Peterson is a great, a fine writer, and I've read his fiction and like it very much. But it's interesting, the heading note for a section of his essay that's titled "The Mormon Liberal" is a very good indicator of the so-called freedom that Bone is critical of. And this is what the heading says, and the essay goes on to talk about this and say this. So this is what Peterson says: "Liberalism suggests an attitude of promoting change within the church, change of a progressive sort, change in the direction of the civilized values evolving in the world at large. Change in the direction of the civilized values evolving in the world at large." It just seems to me, and I think David Bone would agree with this too, it just seems to me that anyone who opts for these sorts of values, so-called, could not possibly have taken a very close look at the world at large in recent decades. And so perhaps the desire for the freedom to participate in this progressive development is in large part a reaction to unwarranted authoritarianism in the Mormon world. But because I don't know how else someone could think that the secular world is the answer if only the church would progress and catch up to it. I think that Bone and others should be more honest, frankly, and clearer about the authoritarian aspects of Mormon institutions and cultures. But while this may explain the desire to live in a secular, free country, apart from the constraints of a community that has claims upon one, this doesn't justify that desire. And every time I read this statement of Peterson's of, you know, these civilized values evolving in the world at large, it boggled my mind, frankly. I don't know how anybody could think that. Well, I've just raised some points, and I really want to just conclude and let's have some discussion, but let me just say a couple more things very quickly. Really, two things. Bone rejects what he calls Enlightenment reason. Its supposed straightforwardness, transparency, neutrality, objectivity, etc. And he invokes philosophers such as Derrida and Gadamer to do this, but this isn't the position that Derrida and Gadamer hold. Why? Because they themselves have a deeply historical, historicist understanding of history, and the Enlightenment is part of history. What you find yourself in, I think, in Bone's framework, is that if you reject that history, the Enlightenment, the Renaissance and Enlightenment, is in kind of a pre-secular conception of community, that's not what Derrida and Gadamer think at all. And there's a bit of selective quotation and proof texting on the part of Bone that isn't really intellectually together, frankly. Yes, Derrida is very critical of the supposed transparency and objectivity of modern secular Enlightenment reason. He wants to know what's excluded by that reason, what's shoved into, pressed into the margins of that reason. But he certainly doesn't argue that opening up that inquiry, trying to open up the possibilities of the margin, means that we should somehow go back to the good old days of the pre-secular world. But instead, he is, and in fact, he's much more in line with some thinkers that he's usually not associated with, but say somebody like Habermas, he is much more in line with the idea of a critical thinking through of all of our history, and this would include the Enlightenment. So you can't just reject that in the way that Bone wants to, and at the same time say that you're being historicist and you're following Derrida or Gadamer or whatever. And that relates to the second point, which is that, and it's a good case for needing a little Enlightenment reason. The idea of the hermeneutic circle that we get from Heidegger, you know, he says there's nothing outside of, there's no going outside of the circle. Or for that matter, the idea of the web of belief that we get from Quine in analytic philosophy. And the idea is basically that our beliefs don't just stand individually, but they hang together in a certain way. and therefore any sense of evidence has to address that. And so evidence comes down to not just this fact or that fact that's just dug up. And frankly, to me, that is the problem with much new Mormon history. It consists mainly in just sort of digging up this or that and holding it out and saying, all right, now what are you going to do? We found out so-and-so. What are you going to do? And, of course, the funny thing is it sometimes presses the church into a kind of reactionary posture in the sense that, you know, for example, uncovering Joseph Smith's participation in what some people would call occult practices, which is such a highly loaded term anyway. I mean, if you look at mainstream Christianity, it's filled with occult. I mean, I don't know how you make a distinction between a salamander speaking to one, you know, not that that really happened, but, you know, a salamander speaking to one or believing that Jonah spent some time in the belly of a whale. I mean, why is one any more occult than the other? But this, you know, digging up the magical worldview of the early Mormons. Well, to my mind, the church should have been proud of that. Should have said, yes, this is a better worldview than scientistic objectivism that views the world in terms of a deep subject-object dichotomy where the world is just a set of objects to be manipulated by human beings. This is a much more integral way of thinking. But out of a kind of reactionary posture, they wanted to say, oh, well, no, we're not part of that occult business. But the problem is when you have this idea of the web of belief or the hermeneutic circle, or the question is there any flexibility to that at all? I mean, can that be addressed at all by evidence? And it seems that in some ways, and especially when you see what I think really is a kind of rhetoric of authority working through Bone and to some extent Lewis Midgley, and of course he's very good at, as you know, at just outright ad hominem attacks, sometimes in a very nasty way, although they're often quite funny, I have to say, then you draw the circle in a very, I don't know what the right word for it is, a very narrowly circumscribed sort of way. And it's interesting, there's a place where, in Bone's argument, where he uses this language, it's really sort of a language of fellow traveling, and let me just read this quotation, then I'm going to end rather quickly. He says, I don't want to assert that some pretext he gives, various agendas that he sees at work in the revisionist history. He says, I don't want to assert that these pretexts constitute anything more than a chaotic mix of overlapping concerns and issues that work in the margins of the revisionist text under the cover of disinterested scholarship. So he doesn't want to say that revisionist history is monolithic and that there's a single agenda and it's just this single anti-Mormon agenda. So he's trying to be a bit generous there. But then he goes on to say, and it doesn't sound like such a nasty claim, but I think there's something nasty behind it, frankly. He says, yet they do share a common interest, his quotation marks, in transmuting the Mormon past in order to recast the future of the church. Thus, in one respect, they walk in tandem. And there's a really kind of creepy language of fellow traveling here. And what does it come down to? Okay, so to put it just very quickly, you know, if you think of there being at least segments of the hermeneutic circle or regions of the web of belief, it seems what this comes down to, while they all walk in tandem, is that if you question any of them, then you're questioning all of them. And then what does that come down to? Don't question. Don't question. Don't think. And so he has this whole, in fact, he has all this whole list of agendas that he sees at work in the revisionist history. Some of them I myself would question. I certainly question the idea that liberalism is any kind of alternative to authoritarianism. I think if that's the only alternative, then we're sunk. I think that's a very, we're in a bad situation. But then he also said, well, then there's this agenda of questioning the situation of women in the church. Well, now you're in the region of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Now you're in the region of saying, so don't question anything. And what's so interesting is what's being said here is that, well, gee, this is not a very vibrant, substantive community after all, because it seems to be saying, well, gee, if you even just pull out one little you know, those games where you stack things up and then you have to, you know, you have to see which blocks you can pull out without letting the thing fall. And he seems to be saying, well, if you pull out any of them, the whole thing's going to fall. So get out. You're out of the circle. And so now to bring this full circle, I guess I'd want to say neither nor to that. I certainly want to say neither to positivism, but I want to say nor to the kind of hermeneutic circle, the kind of use of Derrida, Gadamer, Levinas, etc., Heidegger, that draws the circle in that way into an authoritarian circle. And why is it authoritarian? You know, it's interesting because he defends authority. He defends authority here. If you actually read Derrida, to my mind, what he's got is a deep critique of authority, Derrida, deep critique of origin. And what is that, you know? Well, the author who says, this is the way it's going to be. Why? You know, well, excuse me, but yours is not to ask why. You know, you do and or die. And, well, that's not good philosophy. That's not good for the community. That's not going to be a community that's really going to be a community for very long. That's going to be some masters and some followers or some slavish minds by and by. So let me quit now, and thank you for listening, and let's just have some comments or questions, whatever you'd like to get into. And I have to repeat your question, so try to make it repeatable if you could. So I'm going to summarize that rather quickly to say that part of the problem is that there's not so much depth on the part of Hill's position. There's some shallowness on the part of Bones, and especially where he doesn't follow out some of the implications of the thinkers he invokes. And in either case, then where are we left with the question of criteria? And so let's actually come back to Jacques Derrida on that point, because here's something that I think Bone could follow out. Derrida doesn't reject criteria. He doesn't reject systematicity. It's certainly true if you read certain of his texts, they don't look like systematic philosophy. Others are very systematic. But what is his argument? Well, his argument, to my mind, is essentially an ethical argument that one should follow out the criteria and systematicity to their furthest point, and then in the end there's something that remains underdetermined. Not utterly undetermined, but underdetermined. And it's true, I think that's not such a bad way to understand what it would mean to live as a Latter-day Saint, that in the end, all of the evidence one way or the other doesn't add up to what amounts to the decision to live in that way. If you want a simpler example, in the end, anybody who's involved in a friendship or a romantic relationship, a marriage, etc., you know, you've got certain evidence, you know, your boyfriend or girlfriend hasn't called you for 2 weeks and you don't know where they are, etc. Yeah, that ought to count for something. And after a while, you know, if no one calls you after about 2 years and you're still sitting in your, you know, lazy boy lounger thinking, but I know she loves me, you know, I know he loves me, no matter what. Well, no, you might start to look at the evidence. But the fact is, in the final analysis, you know, friendships, love, relationships, and that's what a community is, a set of relationships. They don't depend on evidence per se, but there still has to be within that some following out of the evidence. There has to be some, as you say, there have to be principles of accountability. And that has to do both with practices and experiences in the world, and a canon of interpretation, right? And at the point when, of course, the leadership of the LDS said, you know, don't follow those dead prophets, you know, only follow the living prophet, you know, which is a very scary thing. I thought those prophets weren't dead. I guess my idea was that they weren't supposed to be dead. Am I wrong about that? I thought the idea was that Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, etc., they were still alive. You know, I find that a very weird thing to say. Well, they're dead. Forget about them. Just follow the living guy. And, of course, I understand. I think it's not a bad principle. I don't want to completely negate that. It's not a bad principle to say, you know, as Thomas Jefferson did, as Karl Marx did, we don't want to keep the living hostage to those who've passed on and aren't in our present situation to really deal with the problems we're dealing with. I think that's a good principle. But there is this canon of interpretation that makes the community, right? And somehow, yes, you're right, all of that has to be accountable. There have to be principles of accountability. We could argue over what those are, and frankly, I don't know entirely what they are, but I know what they're not. They're not just saying, I'm the living prophet, this is it, you listen to me, I don't want to hear anything you have to say. You know, that's nowhere. So, I didn't call on Cheryl yesterday, so I'm going to call on you today. Sorry, I didn't call on you yesterday. So we'd have to ask about the motivations behind the article and what agendas at work there. And yeah, I agree with that. Although, Bowen, I mean, I frankly like the article more than you do. I think on the whole it's got a lot of good stuff in it. And that, yes, it does have a political agenda, but so does everything. And we might make a distinction. Bowen tries to make it at the beginning of his article between a mere stratagem, what will get me ahead, and, you know, a political agenda in the sense of thinking the polis, thinking what kind of community do we want to have here? But as you say, yeah, you have to worry. And what worries me in the case of the firings, and I wrote Rex Lee to say this, and I said it rather bluntly. I said, here you want to fire two people who are very dedicated to the community. And what comes out of all of this? Well, you promote the people who are frankly the brown nosers and the ass kissers, and you make them your model citizen of the community. You know, the yes person, the, well, I'll go along with people. Yes, I'm a good doobie of the community. And then the people who, yes, they want to raise questions, you know, about where this community is going, which would seem to show, and in some cases, frankly, in some of the cases of the revisionist historians, I don't trust it. I don't trust those who just want to say, well, why can't we be a nice church like the Presbyterians? Well, who needs that? Go join the Presbyterians if that's what you want to do. But those who really have the, you know, the question of what kind of community will this be and how do we build it and how do we go forward with it and how do we build Zion in the world, and my understanding is that that is, I've mainly talked with Professor Knowlton, but I certainly get that vibe from him. And, you know, if you get rid of him, but you just keep the people who say, yes, sir, what do you want me to do? I will ask no questions. Well, again, you're not going to have a community by and by. You're just going to have a set of leaders and brown nosers. So since I've brought you into this, David, I think that's a great set of questions. If I could just respond briefly. So part of the question had to do with the fact that there's not a level playing field, so to speak, intellectually or disciplinarily. You have a certain naivete on the part of many of the historians. You have a certain sophistication on the part of people such as David Bowen. And by the way, I mean, if you read the article, he's constantly telling you how smart he is. Constantly telling you, I've read more Gadamer than you. I've read more Derrida than you. Well, gee, I've studied with Derrida, for heaven's sakes. Okay, so why don't I call up and say, I win the argument, David. I mean, you know, I've read more than you. I mean, you know, that's a bit of a... That's pretty disingenuous as well. And David Knowlton also spoke about getting beyond this attack mode to the real question of how does one really live in a community of faith. And frankly, I mean, from my own situation, if I could just mention it briefly, as someone who's been involved in radical social movements for some time now, it's a huge question there also. Because the question is, how do you be an intellectual, and what's the point of being an intellectual in a community that has claims on you? When intellectual means something like thinking experimentally, asking hard questions, and when often the community, as it's constituted in whatever present we find ourselves, finds those questions a distraction. At best, and sometimes as undermining itself at worst. And, I what's interesting, I don't think the Mormon community solved that problem, but if you look at other attempts at building community, transforming the world, building Zion in the world, it hasn't been solved there either. That's why this is such a good debate. I mean, it doesn't apply just to Mormon history. It doesn't just apply to Mormon intellectuals. To be a bit naive about it, yeah, we need more good faith attempts to solve that to get beyond some of the mere stratagem approach. So the question had to do with how one does sustain this participation in the community, and the speaker began by saying that she would simply speak from the heart, and I think that speaks to the question very eloquently, because apart from fairly abstract debates about, fairly difficult debates about European philosophers, that's really what it comes down to, is your heart. I'm not philosophically very much inclined to the idea of what's internal to oneself. I think that's constituted in a social way and in a environmental way, in a kind of fabric of relationships. But on the other hand, one aspect of the question is how do people live community? And it won't come down to your heart or my heart individually, but it will come down to our hearts. It will come down to whether people are able to live in this way, and whether people are able to live in this way in such a way that sustains not only our minds but our hearts and souls, or whether it just becomes another thing you do on Sunday. You know, the probably a strange reference, but the sort of thing that innumerable Jethro Tull songs are about. You know, religion is just going to Sunday school on Sunday and that's it. And I take it that the LDS community has a different standard than that. It has to sustain itself 7 days a week and over long lifetimes. And it has. It has. I mean, don't get me wrong. It has. But at a certain point, that can change from being a community to being something else. And I think that's a lot of what's up for debate right now. It's up for debate in the international context, which, again, David Knowlton spoke to yesterday. And where that's going to go from here, I don't think it's enough to just rest on our laurels. I mean, we have to take responsibility for this. And in a certain sense, we have to say that, well, we can't just let the brethren do all the work. We can't just let the leadership do all the work. If it's really going to be a community, everyone has to take responsibility for this. And I think the heart is not a bad place to come from on that issue.